innovative aging technology. What is it? And how are elder caregivers, educators, and industry partnering to meet the needs of our aging population? The SUNY Oswego Metro Center, Impara, and WRVO Public Media organized a symposium on aging technology that offered a glimpse into a future when living to 100 will be commonplace. Sponsored by MedTech, the symposium featured a presentation by MIT AgeLab founding director Dr. Joseph Coughlin, followed by a panel discussion on the future of aging services, policy, and technology. This event was held at Menorah Park in DeWitt, New York, in October 2012.
Good afternoon. I'm Catherine Loper. I'm the Director of News and Public Affairs at WRVO. And if you're not familiar with WRVO, we are the public radio station based in Oswego. We're on the SUNY Oswego campus, but our region is wide. We go north all the way up to the Canadian border through Watertown, south down to Cortland, halfway to Rochester, and east to Utica. Half of my title is Director of Public Affairs, and that's why I'm so pleased to be here today, because we want to participate in the discussion with this community about issues that are important to this community. And I can't think of an issue that covers more areas than aging, and to talk about the way technology can help us help our senior community in the years to come, I think is very important and hits on all different parts of our society. So I want to thank Menorah Park and SUNY Oswego and MedTech for sponsoring this. But my job is to introduce our keynote speaker, Dr. Joseph Coughlin. As you probably are aware, he is the founding director of the MIT AgeLab, and he also teaches for the MIT School of Engineering and the Department of Urban Studies and Planning. He's on the cutting edge of this topic we're going to dedicate our afternoon to. He's also worked on novel approaches for financing retirement, and in fact, Dr. Coughlin was featured in the Wall Street Journal as one of the 12 people who are changing your retirement. He's also got a great interest in transportation, leading the New England University Transportation Center, and he's co-editor of the book Aging America and Transportation, Personal Choices and Public Policy. He advised a number of corporate and government entities, including serving on President Bush's Conference on Aging Advisory Committee, and he's a regular contributor to the Huffington Post and has appeared in countless other media. So I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Coughlin, but first I'll say my favorite part of his resume is that he has roots here in Central and Northern New York, being a SUNY Oswego alum and having spent many parts of his childhood in Northern New York as well. So I give you Dr. Coughlin.
Thank you very much. I want to talk to you about aging and innovation. Now, usually you don't think about old age and new ideas coming together, but frankly, we have to do that. Frankly, aging is a great thing, because have you ever considered the alternative? And the fact is that what we need to do is not just to live longer, but what we want to do is live better. This is the new number I all want you to start thinking about, 100. What do we do with that additional time? If you think about it, life expectancy in the year 1900 was roughly 47. Today, the average life expectancy is easily in their late 70s, but the fact of the matter is, the fastest growing part of the population is over 85 plus, and above that is over 100. In fact, if anyone here ever goes to the west coast of Florida, particularly Destin, Florida, there are 100 drivers over the age of 100 with active driver's licenses. So think of that next time you're backing out of a driveway down there. So 100 should be the new planning number. Here's the difference. Our parents believe that over time, quality of life is going to begin to decline. I'm going to spend less, feel a little less well, maybe not make as many trips. But the boomers believe, because they have been the center of the universe for 66 years, that there's going to be a pill, there's going to be a silver bullet, there's going to be a public policy that's going to make it a little bit better. This is what's going to be driving real innovation. And part of the innovation is that now we have the technology to do something about it. So let me show you some things that are trend lines. These are just a few things I cherry-picked to give you an idea of where technology is going. And by the way, some of it's going to be really cool, and some of it, to put it in a technical term, is just going to be outright creepy. So speaking of creepy, here's some underwear that I will be able to track you anywhere on the planet within about 5 meters of accuracy, and also tell whether you've wet your pants. This is great for nursing homes. It's great for a variety of reasons. It's also great, unfortunately, for Alzheimer's patients that may wander. This is a TV that was developed by Philips. We helped out a bit, that allows you to take all the bandwidth of programming that you may be interested in, say, as a diabetic, and be able to watch it in one place, but more importantly, be able to have a video conference with a doctor or a nurse about whether you're maintaining your weight, are you managing your medications correctly, so that you have a personalized channel on demand as you need it. This is currently being piloted outside of Philadelphia. It is on the market today in Germany. Blood pressure cuffs, everyone is fumbling with them, not a bad problem, but we already have gone into FDA trials as well as in animal facilities as well, under subdermal, i.e. under your skin sensors, where you'll have either blood pressure, glucose measures, a variety of things in your body, and it will be talking to your cell phone, from your cell phone up to whatever call center it goes to. And I'll give you an example of what that might mean in a moment. This is a spoon developed by a colleague of mine on campus. It's not just your average spoon, it tattletales on your bad habits. So we all have to have one or two or three vices. Mine are Ghirardelli brownies. And by the way, they don't put enough chocolate in the box for me, so I add more. This spoon allows you to go through and make up the mix, and it will say, gee, the calorie count is X, there's this much fat, and then by internet, send that information either to your doctor or to my wife. I'm not sure which one I'm scared of more. But the idea is that I want you to start imagining environments that are ageless, that will be talking to all kinds of things and a variety of services to help you manage, monitor, and motivate good, healthy behaviors. Now, let me show you the ultimate connectivity. This is a smart toilet. Now, a few of us were talking earlier about our trips to Asia. Smart toilets are pretty common in Taiwan and Japan and the like. And what I mean by a smart toilet, well, it's close to lunch, so I'll keep it clean. They download information, shall we say, from the user regarding, did you take your medication? Are you eating well? Your body temperature, your body weight, and then upload that information again via call center. In this case, to Metropolitan Tokyo, to 60,000 congestive heart failure patients, to Tokyo Hospital to be able to monitor, manage, and motivate good, healthy behaviors. Now this toilet, and by the way, those toilets are on the market now by Panasonic and Toto. So these have been out there for a while and they're getting cheaper. This toilet is the British version of the toilets. It seems that the Brits have now entered the toilet wars. It is currently in a pilot program connected to one of the largest grocery store chains. It facilitates home delivery of the foods that your toilet thinks is missing from your diet. You see, you know, the future is here. It's just not widely distributed. The thing I want you to watch, and for those of you that are aging services providers, for those of you that live in rural areas, you should now look at business, particularly retailers, as being powerful platforms and partners for aging services. We are no longer going to have aging services in the back of abandoned strip malls or in community centers. Get out front. If you're not next to a Starbucks, you're not relevant, and you're not going to meet the new needs of an aging population. So caregiver support. Walgreens bought a nursing company. They are now knocking on doors in the Midwest right now, delivering COPD equipment, diabetic care, and having nurses go and provide care to the point of demand. This system here is developed by EDS, now HP, is providing video conferencing care with exceedingly high resolution to the point where you have to touch the glass to know there's not a person there to do retirement planning as well as disease management. And we also know that CVS, Walmart, and the like are putting clinics in the store, which you don't know and you won't see until about a year from now, is that they are going to start to have clinics that are diabetes or disease-specific care centers. You're about to see medicine not move from the hospital to the home. That's the old discussion. It's always been in the home. It's always been in the hospital. You're about to see health and aging go retail. This is a device we developed. This is then-Governor Dirk Kempthorne from Idaho using a kiosk we developed. It does all the boring things that most kiosks do, weighs you, tells you where your blood pressure is, differences in real time, pick up the telephone. You can then talk to a doctor and get a second opinion on saying, my sinuses are killing me, I'm taking a blood pressure meds, can I take Sudafed? The idea is to get real time information at the point of decision. See, these are farm animals. MIT, we don't spell very well, so that's PHARM animals. And they have a picture of your grandchild on there. And remember those Tamagotchi pets that we had years ago that our kids had, that if you don't play with them, they get noisy or they die? Well, in this case, if you don't take your meds, your grandchild's happy picture begins to change, fade, and eventually, if you still don't interact with it, die. Now, the next generation, however, is the following. They are bunnies. And you get a bunny, and your grandchild gets a bunny, and they're connected by pager technology so they can be across the country. If they don't do their homework and go to soccer practice, or you don't eat well and take your meds or go for your walk, the other one's bunny gets sick. So what's more motivational? The doctor's office going, well, Joe, you should be taking your meds and you should be exercising. The wife who's annoying you, or the adult daughter who forgot to say hello but just say, hey, did you take your meds? Goodbye. Or the 12-year-old granddaughter who calls up and goes, Grandpa, my bunny's sick. Are you taking your meds? This is our personal advisor. We did it with Procter & Gamble. What it does is it takes your personalized diet information and allows you to go through the store aisle using barcode today, radio frequency identification, that is little computer chips on the side of the package. Walmart has mandated RFID, as it's called, will be on all its products in the next couple years. It allows you to go through the store aisle, scan it underneath there, and it'll say, gee, Joe, you chose your parents badly, step away from the Ghirardelli brownies, and try something with a little less sugar, a little less fat. It will never move you from brownie to an apple because human behavior just doesn't go that far. Now, long-term care is an issue that all of us have to deal with, especially if you're a woman, have to deal with it more. This is a novel concept that is in the making now and is actually in pilot testing in South America. I want you to imagine having a long-term care facility delivered to your house. So it comes up like a modular home. In fact, it is a modular home. You've got long-term care bedding. You've got all the telemetry, including the smart toilet and accessibility, telemedicine, video conferencing, and 100% accessibility dropped to the house. Service providers come, go, it's in your yard, the whole bit. When you're done with it, you pick it up and you have it taken away. Adaptive homes, this is the space station's kitchen. It's $3 billion. You don't want to change that out every time you want a renovation. So the architect, Guy Trotti, works in my lab, who designed that, is now designing kitchens that are now plug and play. So the fastest growing part of the population doing home modification and repairs are people between the ages of 45 and 55. While they're remodeling for fun, remodel to age in place. Robotic support. This wheelchair we currently have in a test facilities at the Boston Home. This is a wheelchair that is powered, nothing new there, but this one will do the following. It'll say, take me to Joe, and using the tag on my ID card, it will find me wherever I am in the facility and take me there. And by the way, the next version of it has a facial recognition. It will remind the person who's got the chair who they're talking to or what their last conversation was. This is Paro. Paro lives in my lab, was developed by a fellow at MIT. It's now commercially available. Paro is a seal, it's a robotic seal. If you touch it, it's got sensors throughout its body, it's got computer vision, it will recognize not just your face over time, but your voice as well, and only respond to you. It is now being used effectively in Denmark, Italy, and Japan for Alzheimer's patients in particular to help calm them in the afternoon. My colleague is developing the spacesuit for a trip to Mars. It takes roughly 17 to 18 months. You leave at age 30, you come back an 80-year-old osteoporotic patient. So that spacesuit, we teamed her up with Carrie Betancourt at Reebok to be able to create a digital Dan skin that you might wear underneath your clothes, underneath your civvies, that will be able to monitor your well-being, your blood pressure, your blood sugar, but also reduce the chances of falling, and if you do fall, reduce the chances of injury. And this is, by the way, a robot receptionist at an aging service center in Tokyo. When you're running out of people, you turn to everything you can. Just very quickly, I thought you might find this interesting. The top four fears of older adults, number one, diagnosis of fatal disease. Number two, losing the ability to drive. Look at this, number three, a spouse being diagnosed with a fatal disease and a financial security of children. This is my particular favorite focus group respondent said, you can always get another wife, but you can only get one driver's license. And this is part of the fleet of cars that we have out on the road. If you ever come to Boston and you see these cars, I suggest you get to the second floor. You have no idea who's driving. The future of the car is going to be able to detect your physical well-being behind the wheel. Are you driving safely? Are you tired? Are you fatigued? But here's the next step. It will then do things to bring you back into optimal performance. We are now looking at the future of houses, workplace, and cars that will actually change their behavior, lighting, temperature, sound, and the like, to be able to get you to perform at the best level possible. And this is Agnes, Age Gain Now Empathy System. And Agnes is a suit we designed for our students, product engineers, and the like around the world to be able to understand and feel, quite literally feel, what it might feel like to be osteoporotic, as well as to have advanced diabetes. So neuropathy, difficulty of walking, that balance idea. You know, if you're not well enough to drive and you've been driving all your life, are you going to wake up one day at age 80 and say, think I'll take the bus? Doesn't happen very well. So how do we rethink of transit to make it more inviting and able to be used? And then lastly, 24/7 advice, that smartphone you have in your purse or on your belt, this is the new platform to connect you, not just to new technologies. That's the easy part. In fact, technology is the easy part. It's the services that it will connect you to. So whether it's taking pictures of, you know, your favorite cheesesteak or whatever it might be, you upload it once a week or once a month, it'll say, gee, Joe, that's, you know, a little heavy in the cheese whiz department. You should be eating something a little bit better. This phone is already on the market. It monitors glucose. It's got a stress monitor, EKG sensor. It's being used by Vodafone in Europe today to be able to monitor rural patients in Greece and Bulgaria. And this is a similar phone being used in South Korea and Japan. So let me end, you know, it's fun to do a little bit of science fiction and science fact. It's fun to tell you about the demographics. But I wanted to try to leave you, if you will, with some ideas or, if you will, action steps. Because I believe that with Oswego as catalyst and Syracuse and Central New York as a resourceful, winning community, that you can be pioneers in rethinking what it means to age in small cities and in rural America. This is a problem that's not coming, it's here today. So here's some things I would suggest. One, we should acknowledge the regional assets we've got around here. As you know, you've got a unique combination of education, medical, aging services, and rural services all within 1 hour's drive of this point right here. You've got knowledge and access to the aging population already. The folks in the audience that I'm looking at your name tags that already do aging services, there are companies around the world that are dying to come up with ideas to reach the population over age 50 if they're caregivers and over age 75 if they're care recipients. But they don't know anything about the population, nor do they have the trust that you engender when you knock on somebody's door. Aging is too big for any one company, it is too big for any level of government, and it is too big for any one family. Successful aging is going to have to be achieved by building partnerships with everyone from retailers, telecommunications, providers, financial services, and all levels of governance. We're going to be looking for people that are trusted advisors. Which one of these crazy smartphones do I use? Which one of these service providers do I want to be knocking on my dad's door in the middle of the winter? You know, to be able to filter out what's popular versus what's useful. For those that are maybe working in long-term care, why are we only providing services that you are scaling to a long-term care facility? So for instance, I know that Brookdale is a large company here in this area. I've done work with them at headquarters. Brookdale and other companies are saying, how can we provide some of the aging services we provide our residents, but be a hub of services outside our facilities as well? And then lastly, produce the next generation of aging services provider. Old age is very new. New expectations, new technologies, new places where they live without families. We need to have the next generation employee look like a partnership maker, be fluent in the technology to be able to provide those services, i.e. what is that future call center going to look like with all these different technologies? We need a whole new range of professionals out there, whether they're engineering and human-computer interaction to design the systems, but also the person who manages a senior housing facility is a very different executive than just your average MBA. There's got to be something different in there. We need to create laboratories of innovation. Don't just make this into a research project. You can't afford that. We need to develop ideas and get it out there in the community, and as I like to tell my students, go out and break something and get it right. I heard an architect on National Public Radio a number of years ago that was interviewed talking about how skyscrapers are statements of optimism. That you can go to a country or a culture and see that if they are building to reach the sky, they're not just doing it because they need space. They're not just doing it to make a statement. There's a feeling of optimism. There's a feeling of can do. This is not your father's old age. We want it better, we want it cheaper, and we've got the technology, and I believe we have the will to do so. So please join with Oswego, myself, and all the other partners that came today, and hopefully let's build a skyscraper of aging that we all want to live in tomorrow. Thank you very much.
I'm going to introduce each panelist, and I just want them to spend a minute or two explaining what they think from based on all their expertise about the use of technology to help age in place. So I want to start by introducing Tony Joseph. He has started a new position as the VP of Long-Term Care Service at Samaritan Medical Center in Watertown. He's responsible for Samaritan Keep Nursing Facility and Nursing Summit Village. They provide skilled nursing, assisted living, and adult day healthcare services. Before that, he was at the Presbyterian Home in New Hartford, and he has also been an adjunct professor at SUNY IT. So Tony, I just want to ask you, based on all of your experience, what do you think is the most important thing we should consider about using technology to help the aging population?
But what we have is you have a aging population that are essentially in rural areas. Their kids go to urban areas, get educated, and stay in those urban areas to get, you know, employed, leaving the aging parent back in the rural area. And this is where technology can be have a major impact, you know, on that, because you can monitor them from the home, and you can get that information to a medical hub, you know, overseen by perhaps a nurse practitioner who's then overseen by the specialty physician that you need to do. So I think that's the what's out there, and that's all over the world. That's not just America, that's all over the world. And how do we take care of that population in a cost-effective way with the use of technology is the challenge. And it's there, and through some of the you know, experiments, things we can trial and do, I know what can be done. If you got 100 people living in a housing for the elderly, really easy to provide home, you know, home services to them. But if you get those 100 people and you spread them around the North Country, where I am right now, very difficult in a cost-effective way to provide them the services that they need. So through technology, you really can take care of both of those groups, and I think that's where we need to center, you know, our efforts.
Thank you. Next, I'd like to introduce Gail Carmichael. She's the Vice President of Clinical Operations for VNA Home Care. She's a registered nurse and has been with VNA for over 33 years. She's authored articles on palliative care, and she's currently on the board of directors for Welch Terrence, am I pronouncing that correctly? It's a nonprofit offering housing and social support for individuals living with HIV. So, Gail, tell us about your experience with VNA and as a nurse, what you think about this technology issue.
Great. My frame of reference actually is individuals who have recently had an health issue. They've either been in the hospital, they've had an illness, an injury, or they're dealing with chronic illness. And so one of the issues that we use to keep people at home, if anyone saw the paper this morning, there was a great article about the initiatives we need to all make to keep people out of the hospital. And so one of the programs we have that uses technology is the home telemonitoring. And I think one of the successes of that program is the pieces that are with the elderly person in their home don't feel foreign and high tech. They feel like a little clock radio. It feels like the same blood pressure cuff that their doctor has used for years. It's a familiar scale, but all those vital signs that they can take every day go to a nurse who monitors those. They don't see that high tech screen. They don't know all of that. But it does present a lot of challenges, and I think one of the issues Dr. Coughlin talked about is how collaborative all of this is. It's nurses who are aging and not always comfortable with technology themselves bringing this to aging individuals. It's patients, families who are promoting it. It's us working with, you need a vendor. You need someone that has a good reputation, that has the right equipment, that has the right software, that's going to be responsive to our needs. And then you have to get the buy-in from physicians and physician groups who we really depend on to be responsive if there are health changes. So it really does become a real effort. But I have to say that we've noticed over time that the hospitalization rate for our patients with telehealth is 10% lower than those without. And so we do know that it's worth all those efforts and that it really can make a difference for people.
Great. Next, I'd like to introduce Dr. Steve Goodman. He is Vice President for Research at SUNY Upstate Medical University and the Dean of the College of Graduate Studies. He's a professor in both the departments of biochemistry and molecular biology and pediatrics. He's researched cell structures and sickle cell disease for 30 years, and he's had some breakthrough discoveries that have paved the way for personalized medicine for those with sickle cell. Since coming to Upstate Medical University, he's been spearheading their efforts to increase research expenditures. And I'd like to just talk to him about being a doctor and a researcher and what that has told you about how technology can help, you know, patients that you have seen.
So probably the thing that I've enjoyed the most over the last 4.5 years since I moved here is leading 3 different research consortia. All have something in common in that they're aimed at the major diseases that affect all of us in this room. And they bring together an interdisciplinary group of both faculty and members of industry to work on these problems. One is a local collaboration, one is across the state of New York, and the other is international, and they involve about 500 people. And I think that in terms of moving forward any area, including aging and research on aging. You need teams of investigators, and you need partnerships not only amongst different institutions, academic institutions, but partnerships between academic institutions and industry. And that's basically what we're about in the three different consortia that I lead.
Great. And we're definitely going to talk about partnering later on. I think that's an important part of this equation. I'd like to introduce Mary Beth McCall. She's VP and Chief Medical Officer of Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield for Central New York and the Southern Tier regions. She is a doctor, an MD in internal medicine. She joined Excellus in 2007. And she's as a physician and a leader in the insurance agents in industry, which is obviously a key component for dealing with senior citizens. Tell us about your thoughts on technology and how that can help seniors.
I must admit it's been really a journey for me, and I mentioned earlier that I've been in private practice, worked in a long-term care facility, worked as a hospital medical director in a few facilities, and now are looking at the payer component. And what we realize along the way is that we're all in it together. And as you know, Blue Cross Blue Shield is a not-for-profit, community-based organization. We insure over 1.8 million people in upstate New York, but we have this whole range of products. So we're learning more about how do we work on financing, trying to find the most cost-effective ways of doing things. One of the things that people have mentioned is looking for grant dollars for telehealth and telemedicine. Well, we've decided within our medical policy component that there are certain times that telehealth and telemedicine is appropriate and should be reimbursed, and at other times it's just a gee whiz. It's pretty cool. It's pretty nice to use, but we don't want to use other people's money to pay for things that are not necessary. So it's that big balance between how do we work on finding the most cost-effective way of caring for folks, and then also recognizing that there will be new technologies with new costs. We also have been working very hard on making sure that we address significant issues with aging, as in healthcare directives, that people understand what people want in the future, how they want to live their lives, what's their important things, what's their goals of care. And then in the physician community, we've been incentivizing the use of patient-centered medical homes, where a physician practice as a team works together to care for a patient. And so that's we've been working and trying to encourage both the quality of care and the structure of care, the team component, through our incentive payments and how we recognize physicians and providers in our community.
Great. Now I'd like to introduce Julie Scheimer. She's the Chief Innovation Officer for Welch Allyn. She recently retired as the CEO. She was the first woman CEO. She came to Welch Allyn in 2002 with 20 years of experience in the computer networking and wireless communications industries. She holds several board positions and is chair of the Empire State Development Corporation. And she's an electrical engineer and encourages women to enter the engineering fields, spends time on that. And so I'd like to talk to you about your background as an engineer and in the business world about this use of technology.
Well, obviously, I have a technology background, so I like technology, even if it didn't help. but at Welch Allyn, we really believe that it does. And there's really two aspects of how we're thinking about aging. One is that the healthcare providers that use our equipment are aging. The average nurse in the United States is 48, and the average physician is 53. And so those of you who may be familiar with our equipment, The first product Welch Allyn ever made or sold in 1915 was a handheld ophthalmoscope. And so if you think about that physician with, all those eyesight things that are happening when you're 50. Yes, I know. And it's harder to find the fundus today than it was 30 years ago, right? So we're thinking about doctors and nurses that are using our equipment that needs to be adapted to make it easier for them to use. And then we're increasingly working with an aging patient base. So we're really concerned about creating the kind of equipment that actually Gail was talking about that can be used in telemedicine, that can be used in long-term care facilities, that makes very accurate data very easy to acquire, and then delivers that data where it's needed to manage chronic conditions. So we're looking at diagnosis tools, screening tools, tracking tools for physicians and other caregivers to help seniors manage health conditions that impact their lives.
Now I'd like to introduce Cindy Nagolian. She is a clinical administrator and senior advisor to Nurses Improving the Care of Health System Elders at the Hartford Institute for Geriatric Nursing at NYU. She has been a nurse for 35 years, is that correct?
Thereabouts, yeah.
at Krauss Hospital. And currently she is maintaining a part-time practice conducting cognitive and affective evaluations and care planning for older adults here in Syracuse. So tell us about your experience both as a nurse and all your experience of what you think technology can really help patients.
Well, I'm going to take a little bit of a different approach, and it's going to be on what Gail touched on and Mary Beth touched on, in that as a nurse gerontologist, the focus of my practice is the patient and the family. And we've talked a lot about all this wonderful technology, but we have to remember who's on the receiving end and how that's going to affect them, and how do we carefully address the patient and family's desires. And that's what patient-family-centered care is. What does the family want? What motivates them? We talked about motivation. What is it that they think about as their quality of life, and how is this going to affect them? So I think part of the equation here of partnering with technology is remembering that our partner is the patient and the family who are receiving the technology. We have to do a very careful approach. We have to give them a lot of time and ready, time to get comfortable with something that's new in their lives. Is this what they want? Is this what they need? I think it's all wonderful. Don't get me wrong. I think it's wonderful that we are meeting quality objectives that are set forth by, you know, healthcare industry now, and that we're keeping people home in where they want to be, or in a home-like environment, that we're keeping them safer, they're better medication management, and hopefully decreasing the medication error that's so prevalent in the home environment. So out of a quality and safety initiative, it's wonderful. And I'm all for it, but we have to remember that we have to step back and make sure we're engaging that patient and family.
Great. And next, I'd like to introduce Ken Piazza. He is the Geriatrics and Extended Care Manager of the Syracuse Veterans Association Medical Center. He's held that position since 2008, and he oversees a wide variety of services to veterans from a 13-county region here in central New York. He's been a national VA consultant and has written and overseen several VA grants for telehome care and telehealth care. And obviously, the veterans are a very important part of our senior and aging community, so tell us about your experience.
As I was listening to everyone else, I was thinking, yeah, that's true. That's true. Oh, good point. The VA is in the thick of the technology applications for a lot of reasons. One, we have a 13-county area that we support veterans. We are, and they're all over the place, and there's concentrations of them, and then they're scattered everywhere. And how do you provide services to them? And as they get older, you know, the transportation and mobility are big issues. So technology is where we're heading. The costs, we often, you know, we provide a continuum of care for a lot of veterans and inherit the costs for each stage of their life. And for us, the payer, you know, we don't have to worry, we're the payer, because it makes sense for us from a financial standpoint. But also from that continuum and caring for them throughout their lives, it makes even more sense. We are constantly exploring with a lot of technology. We go from something very simple, but we found effective through a grant process that we've had with just using the telephone and seeing how much we could do for case management for dementia program. We have home telehealth. We have 7 telehealth nurses providing a daily monitoring of over 500 patients in the 13-county area, using a number of modules and covering a number of disease entities. And Linda Giles, she represents that group. We also do studies and show that the home telehealth does reduce readmissions, reduce the cost of admissions, reduces the frequency of admissions. However, what she did is she combined some good old-fashioned nursing patient education module with home telehealth and got an additional amount of compliance with a patient set, and she can tell you a little bit about that. Our chief of prosthetics and sensory aids, who has a $40,000 knee that originally was made for young veterans, but the initial technology wasn't responsive enough, and they found that for a middle-aged person like myself or older, that it processed just fine. So those kinds of technologies, as high-tech as they are are keeping our veterans at their homes. My Healthy Vet is basically a web-based portal where we have 20,000 patients signed up and 5,000 actual users right now that are able to, from their computer at home, make appointments, order their medications, and send secure messaging to their providers. We have clinical video technologies, which is basically a virtual visit capability. One of the things that we had to do in terms of aging in place, we're a regional medical center, so we had to provide our specialty services to our 8 community-based clinics so that a lot of our veterans don't have to drive 2-3 hours to the main medical center. And Bill Ashby and Jordan are in the throes of enlisting our different specialists to provide that. In fact, our geriatrics group memory disorder team just demoed it with a patient a couple weeks ago. They are also experimenting with providing the virtual visit in the home. And we also have some caregiver support groups that are going to be experimenting with that as well, because our focus is no longer on the veteran. And actually, it really never has been, but through laws over the last couple of years, we now formally can say that we work with and do things for the caregiver, because we know where that's at. And we have a very active caregiver support program that uses these technologies too. I just wanted to introduce the fact that we are doing a lot of this, and there's a lot more experimentation going on. In the studies I've looked at, the average age of the veteran population is about 4 or 5 years in advance of the general population. And so some of the swelling that's going with the aging, we're there already. Because of the costs and as well, and the fact that we are a provider of care, we are a payer of care, and we inspect care, and the focus on the caregivers as well, it's just a confluence of reasons why we're investing in the technology.
Dr. Coughlin, I want to bring you back into the discussion. We've talked a lot about the different things that are being invented and the technologies that are coming to the forefront, but what have you seen from the national scene in various places about the challenges to bringing those into use? Because as you said, you want to get those out there and get those technologies used. What do you see as the biggest challenge to doing that?
The first one I'm sure that everyone has at the top of their mind, they just haven't asked it yet, which is cost. There's good news and bad news on that. These things start off exceedingly expensive. How many of you bought a computer when they first came out, the personal computer? 1985, yeah, you're all as silly as I am, paying $5,000 for something now that has the power of a boat anchor. And now you can buy a touchscreen, which we've been using for telemedicine support in France and Japan and the United States, on touchscreen computers for less than $300 a pop. So the prices do come down, but there is a question of technological equity. Some can afford this, some may not. The second thing is, which is related to cost, is that researchers and practitioners alike are innovating by asking the following, which may be a practical business question, but not a good innovation question, is, will this get reimbursed? It's an appropriate business question, but I have to ask you, do you think the internet would have been invented by focus group? Would it have been invented if we had asked whether it would be reimbursed? And so as a result, we have a lot of good researchers and a lot of good engineers that are spending a lot of time on trying to invent how people do their work today, but make it more efficient. That's like using your current computer the way you use, and this will show my age, the same way you used a Selectric typewriter or a Smith Corona. It's very different. And I guess the third challenge I see is that we need to mainstream aging. Those technologies that exist, those services that exist, currently are only available through traditional senior services, discharge nurses, and hospitals. Ladies and gentlemen, we will not age well, we will not take full advantage of technology, nor will we actually be able to help caregivers until these solutions are available on Amazon, Best Buy, and CVS. When it becomes commonplace where aging is something we all do, and services are all the things that we want to access, not because they're special, but because that's the new norm of living, then we will start to age better.
Mary Beth, maybe you want to address the cost issue a little bit too from the insurance point of view. I might be able to go out and buy my mother the newest technological device to help make her life better, but some people are dependent on what can be reimbursed. And how do you think we will go forward facing what Dr. Coughlin mentioned?
Well, there's two actual areas that we look at when we talk about who pays for what. Remember that an insurance plan is that everybody puts in a little bit of money, and some people really need it. And a lot of it goes towards one person because we've all chipped in that pot and put that money in the pot. Well, as we all need more and more, we either pay more and more into the pot, or we say there are certain things that can be proven to be helpful, and that's when we develop medical policies. And so if you look at the way an insurance company develops medical policies, it's you read the literature, we look and see where is the benefit going, who's paying for what, and would somebody, a normal person, say that's a good thing to pay for? And do we say then to the evidence-based literature, this really has made sense? And so if you look at over the last 2 years, we have gone from not paying for telemedicine visits to having a medical policy that says if you're in a rural area, if you have a synchronous face-to-face, like a doctor's visit, but happens to be miles and miles away, we'll pay for that just as if it's a physician's visit. We pay 85% to the person who provides the care and 15% to the person who sends that person. So it's sort of fair, it's revenue neutral, and it provides the care that's necessary with everybody being involved. And so that's been a 2-year process. Now when we look at telehealth monitors, we know that there's certain care that's paid for that actually gets a prospective payment, especially through Medicare. And that's a group lump sum payment. And if an organization can figure out how to deliver that care more effectively with devices or with equipment, we say it's really not in our business plan to pay more for your efficiency. If it's your efficiency and you're not paying travel for a nurse to go out, then you buy the equipment, you use it appropriately, and you'll still have your lump sum and there still will be savings. So we're very, very deliberate about what we pay for. And I have had some visits from technology folks saying, would this be reimbursed? And at one time I did say, that is really cool. I would buy one, but I wouldn't pay you to provide them for people because it's not what other people really need. And so we're very deliberate. It's not that we just say no, and we think about it a lot.
Does anyone else want to address the cost issue?
Talk a little bit about it. It does add efficiencies to providing care, I have to say. And it changes how you go about delivering services because, you know, in the past, you want someone's vital signs and they're home, you go to their home and you take their vital signs and you do it as often. And you have coffee, yes. Very important. And you do it at your own schedule. And then when we started, you know, spacing out visits and teaching people symptoms, then all of a sudden, maybe you're going every Monday because that's your schedule. Well, now with telehealth, we can look at going to see this person when it's important, when a change has happened, when there's some significant issue that we can go address, when we can lay our eyes and hands on that individual because we know there's some sign that things are changing. And that's better care, and it's more efficient, and it really helps us use telehealth as a tool rather than as a replacement for how we were all brought up with the nursing hands-on, you can't replace the human touch kind of thing. And so you do get the best of both worlds, I think, if you learn to practice differently.
What are some of the other challenges as far as training for your nursing staff and the people who are using that technology? What are the challenges that are faced to get people to be able to use these things? Cindy, maybe you want to address that?
It's a whole paradigm shift for nursing, I think, in healthcare in general, in that, again, we are going to the patient and family and finding out more about them and trying to honor their wishes and values. So you begin a process with them from hopefully beginning in the hospital environment. There are transitional care programs that are emerging that have been very beneficial in that you engage the family, begin the engagement in the hospital, and then you work with them in the same nurse, or there's a handoff to another nurse in the home environment. Again, fostering their ability to self-manage, teaching them symptom management, what do you call the physician for, coaching them to be able to care for themselves. So it's a paradigm shift because we're used to doing for. Nurses always wanted to do for. We have to sit on our hands, they say, literally, when you do these new approaches, and let the patient begin to understand how to do for themselves. It's then when you get the buy-in and the motivation, connect the dots for them from behavior to how perhaps they wound up in the hospital. It takes time for them to sometimes recognize that, oh, the fact that I wasn't taking my Lasix every day because I prefer to go out shopping or have the hairdresser, so I'm not going to take my Lasix 2 or 3 times a week, but I have congestive heart failure, and connecting the dots with them and how that wound up being why they were hospitalized. So it's actually coaching, teaching, and it's nurses helping the patient to better understand. I'm using various different approaches instead of, here, let me do it for you, which is what our innate instincts are, is to just take over and do it for the patient. and that doesn't help them at all.
There is the acclimation to the equipment, to the technology, to the concepts of doing something differently, but we found in most of our programs, the initial trepidation, whether you're talking about a provider being part of delivering the service or the recipient, there's some trepidation often, not always, you know, there's a lot of people that are gung-ho about it, but there is trepidation, and then once they start playing, and that's the key, once they start playing, they grab onto it with a vengeance, and they love it. But I think a greater challenge is basically the symphony that has to go on to provide a technology. You need, especially if you're going high tech or even medium tech, a TV hardly works today without a remote, and the remote needs a battery. Okay, the batteries die, so there's a supply issue there. There's maintenance issues. There's upgrade issues. There's compatibilities between old versions and new versions. Do you decisions about whether you invest in the next edition versus the prior edition? There's competencies of the staff. There's maintenance agreements possibly that you have to talk about. There's the cost. Who's paying for it? How much do you buy? Then you have to make. You know, it's a whole management system that usually envelops the whole delivery model. It's not simple. It's just not like handing out a piece of candy or a pill even. You know, there's a lot to it, and it doesn't stop. It keeps going.
What about infrastructure and government and laws? And what do you see needs to be changed to make it easier to bring innovation to seniors? Are there roadblocks that you all are facing in those arenas at all? We haven't discussed that. Tony?
I won't talk about that, but no, there are things, and they have, you got to really watch the insurances and stuff and the telemedicine to make sure the docs are licensed and overstate. So they're overcoming a lot of that. A lot of it's still in legislation and so forth. But I want to just talk a little bit about the cost. Just to give you an example, we started a telemedicine program for those with Parkinson's disease back in 2001, and it was about $40,000 we invested in the equipment to do it. Today, $3,500 maybe. Maybe you can get it less than that, just to give you an idea of what we were talking about with the reduction in the cost. And I think with doing it, we did it in a nursing facility and we did it in the home settings. But just to give you an example, for those people with Parkinson's disease, we were able to set up, just design rooms based on what they told us to make their life easier. So we had, voice-activated shades that would open and close. We had voice-activated bed that would, instead of scooching them up, you could just tell the bed to rise. We had chairs that would lift through voice activation. We put in lava, those lava things from the 60s. Not that I know, my father told me about them, but those lava things. But there was we learned that those movements could sometimes break a freeze. How did we know that? We asked the person that's dealing with the disease. We did the shades because they said we take so many meds, Tony, my eyes have a difficult time with the light, coming in. Not that we get that much in central New York, but when you get that sun, they were able to tell the shades to close and the shades closed. They said, their mouth got parched because of the medications they had to take, and the nurses had to keep coming in and out. So we just put a motion-activated water thing, because you put a thing in front of it, it's going to be very difficult with tremors and so forth to be able to pour yourself, a glass of water. So we put a lot of things in based on that person's telling us what to do, and then the technology did it. It was just like if you go to the psychiatrist and you say, these are my problems. Well, that's what we told the Parkinson's. Just tell us your problems. Technological people just took care of every one of their problems. And we did a lot of it at Radio Shack. It was not expensive stuff. Just a little motion would open the door, a little motion thing would, a bathroom was hands-free and so on. So we were able to do it very cost-effectively. So I think when you look at technology, the government has had problems in the past, as with the insurers in the past, but you can see the improvements now and the progress that's been made, and it's been really helpful.
I was just going to mention that sometimes we do wind up with regulatory gaps and difficulties. As many of you know, we've been developing a regional health information organization that gathers all the information from multiple different sources and then it provides it to the facilities and physicians who are caring for these patients. The issue with much of that is first, it's good to figure out how to get it started, because if we could prevent someone from getting a repeat test done, it was going to be significant cost savings. If we could provide good history, we could potentially keep someone from getting a drug that was going to cause an allergic reaction. So it was all these very, very good things. But then in the implementation piece, every single hospital of the 19 hospitals in our region have different software. And so there's interaction with that software. So we did find a vendor that was able to interact with those. But then we're trying to hook up physician offices, and we have 10 different electronic medical records to actually enter that in. And then we get to the patient, and the patient is asked to consent. Well, you know, that's a big deal. I actually signed my first Rio consent this morning when I had a test done, and they said, do you know anything about healthy connections? And I said, I know a real lot about it. And they said, do you want to consent? And I said, yes. But I'm not sure that I could have had an engaged conversation with that person about, well, what does it mean? You mean my stuff is going to go into this big mass of information and delivered wherever somebody wants it? Well, right now I'm okay. I don't really have anything to hide, and I couldn't hide it from anybody anyway. But if I had something to hide, would I want to consent, and would I be able to consent? Now, in New York State, you have to consent for every single step of the way, so you're going to get really annoyed with being asked for consents. In some other states, like in Iowa, you opt out. So everybody's in the Rio unless you say, I don't want this information there. And so it really does say what kind of environment we're in, and do we make it easier to adopt this really wonderful technology of information sharing.
I think we could talk for a whole hour about information sharing and the problems of medical records, et cetera. I do want to talk about partnering, though. And if you all could address the issues or the good things that have come up about trying to partner between various agencies, private business, government, that sort of thing. Julie, maybe you want to address that.
Yeah, I think that's really important because the whole subject of aging, and I'm just talking about the healthcare piece, which, as Joe pointed out, is a small piece of the whole subject. But even if you just take healthcare delivery, it's a very complex business. And, you know, we're talking, sitting here, we have people who deliver healthcare in various settings. We have people who pay for it. We have people who develop technology for it. And we really do need to work together. And I think one of the challenges for us as an industry is, we're in business. We're in business to deliver products that help our customers and to make money doing it. But we need a lot of data. We're required from a regulation standpoint to get a lot of clinical data, but we also need a lot of data about the workflow, the way nurses and doctors and patients want to use this. So for us, it's just critical that we have relationships. We have relationships with universities. We have relationships with providers. We have relationships where we can get clinical data. And I think one great thing about Central New York is it's big enough to have lots of the resources you need to partner to solve some of these problems, but it's small enough that people can pay attention to it. And, you know, you can actually have a face-to-face connection. You can know the people you can trust, you know, people in the payer community, people in the university community. So for us as an organization, it's really critical for us to partner. And a lot of our innovation has come with partnering from local hospitals and local universities and local researchers.
Dr. Goodman, did you want to talk about partnering at all? Because obviously, as a research hospital and university, that's a big, big component of what you all do.
So the way that research is being done today is drastically different than when I got my PhD. When I got my PhD, most investigators, at least in field of biomedical research or biological research, would hole up in their laboratories. If they did any partnering at all, it would be with the laboratory next door, and that was about it. Now, to answer any significant question in human health, in biomedical research, it truly requires a very interdisciplinary team of scientists. Again, people in the biologic sciences, people in the physical sciences, engineering, computer sciences, mathematical sciences, have to be working together to solve these questions, and that's why we've created these consortia that I'm involved in. Another aspect is that relationship between academics and industry. You will find, for example, in the area of drug discovery and development, again, back when I was getting my PhD, people within academic institutions were not working on drug development and discovery. Now, you can go into any major academic health center in the United States, in their pharmacology departments, they're gonna have lots of people working on it. And because of the economics, both within industry as well as academic institutions, there are now lots of partnerships that are being created both between academic and industry in the area of drug discovery and development.
I think it's about time to wrap things up. I know we could keep talking about this for quite a long time, but I would just like to ask you, Dr. Coughlin, to leave us with some final thoughts for the folks in the room who are dealing with aging issues and the professions dealing with our senior communities about what we should be thinking going forward to help people to live longer and live better.
Once again, I'd like to thank everyone for having this event tonight, Menorah, MedTech, Oswego State. And I think the fact that we're convening this event is a reason for optimism. First off, you're living longer than you've ever done before. So let's enjoy it. Let's invent what that future is going to be. Secondly, we have organizations, insurers, medical device manufacturers, researchers, and engineers creating all new technologies that with your creativity to define the requirements of what you want, the engineers will be able to deliver on those. So the new frontier is to live longer, live better with new technology, new partnerships, but also a new way of thinking about old age, that it should not be just that period where we wait and languish, but to take that idea of 30 or 40 years of more life that we can come together and invent fun, education, and whether or not your spouse is willing to put up with another 30 years of the same jokes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to thank all the panelists. You've brought such a wealth of expertise, and like I said, we could have talked about these topics for hours and hours, but I want to thank all of you for your participation. I found it very educational and informational. I hope all of you in the audience did too. And thank you, Dr. Coughlin, for a whole day of events discussing this issue here in Syracuse. My thanks to our sponsors, Impara, SUNY Oswego Metro Center, and MedTech. Thanks to Menorah Park for hosting, and a special thanks to Judith Wober of Impara, Kim Armani of SUNY Oswego Metro Center, and Jill Zimmerman of MedTech for making this all happen logistically. And on behalf of WRVO Public Media, I want to say thank you for letting us participate in this important community discussion today. So thanks very much.
You've been listening to a discussion organized by the SUNY Oswego Metro Center, Impara of Syracuse, and WRVO Public Media. Sponsored by MedTech, the symposium featured MIT AgeLab founding director, Dr. Joseph Coughlin. It was moderated by WRVO Director of News and Public Affairs, Catherine Loper. This event was held at Menorah Park in DeWitt, New York, in October 2012. For more information about the Innovative Aging Technology Symposium, visit wrvo.org/innovativeagingtechnology.